So we'd like to open it up for questions from the audience. Please raise your hand and wait for for Carl, who'll be bringing the microphone. Any questions for Dr. Conquest? Because we have right up here on the right.
So if you normalize the situation in the 20th century for the population increase, it seems that the world is probably safer for the individual now than it was, say, in 15th century Scotland or time of the Roman Empire, I would think. You want to comment on that?
I don't have the figures, but there were periods then. The Black Death was as much trouble as any of the genocides here, of course, on the health side. But there have been ups and downs then. And we've had ups and downs. The first part of this century was far better than the second part, or the second 50 years. Health, yes, sure. But it's not much good being healthy at being 90 years old if you've got an atom bomb dropped on you. But the health is extremely important, and again, it does come into foreign policy vis-à-vis Africa, for example. This raises a lot of issues which I don't really deal with.
I read The Great Terror many years ago, when it first came out, or very close to when it first came out. And I'm wondering what you have learned since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and a lot of the archives have opened. What new things have you learned since then that you can add into The Great Terror?
Well, I did a second edition about 10 years ago. And there's a lot since then, quite a lot of new material. We know a lot more about the inner workings of the secret police and who they were. We have there's a great deal of detail. I don't know that there's anything really essential, but I do mean to do another edition, a definitive one. We've got enough to be definitive.
Has the scale changed at all in terms of the number of people that were killed, the number of people that were incarcerated?
There's still argument about that, but there are ups and downs. Some figures have gone up and others have gone down. I mean, we certainly overestimated certain types of figures. But I mean, my figure, for example, for the number of executions under Stalin is about right now increase it slightly, whereas there are probably fewer in one of the other categories. But that's a very difficult one to get right. We know a hell of a lot about a number of the demonstration in Washington. One side says there are 100,000, another says there's 200,000. The police say these are very difficult things to get correct. But we know, for example, up to 1937, we now have what used to be when I wrote. The census of that year had been suppressed. There's an announcement that the census takers had been arrested, they were shot, in fact, for lowering the population, lowering the figure of the population. So they suppressed that census, got another one in 39. And we know now that the 39 census was at least 3 million too much. I mean, 3 million on paper, non-existent, and probably more, actually. I mean, so that sort of thing is input, new input.
You mentioned the eroding of the consensual state through big corporatism. I wonder if you could expand somewhat on those thoughts.
Well, this is not more than a general feel, but I get the impression that if we take an example, take a country which is now producing a mixture of state and semi-free enterprise, China. Now that we may say is a bad example, and America and Britain aren't going that way. But there's an enormous amount of intervention by the state and of acceptance of intervention by big companies, even here, I think. To take a sort of minor example, it discourages smaller companies, if the big company accepts a foolish charge of some sort and pays $1 million fine, which they do. They do. You remember that curious thing, Texarko, where a director was accused of having made a racist remark, which he hadn't made, it turned out. And they just paid up. And well, can you imagine, a big company can afford to, as it were, bribe the liberals, to put it in a coarse fashion. And whereas that's only a minor side of it. I don't think that here it's anything like as powerful as it would be, say, in Japan, or indeed to some extent in France, of course. In France, they now talk about pink fascism, which what they mean is that the deputies, quite a few of the deputies, are still bureaucrats. They're allowed to keep their jobs. Well, I mean, a high proportion. I've got it in here somewhere. And they overlap very much with the trade unions and with the big corporations, because only the big corporations can afford to exist and be, in effect, I won't use the word bribed, but let's say fixed a bit, with the unions demanding more than the country can really afford. There are several ways one can go on about that, but it's worth looking at. I expect you will do it.
You mentioned the importance of the American United Kingdom model for humankind in the future, and also the consensual society as a model. What do you see in your years of observation of the United Kingdom and America as far as the trends moving forward in the right ways to bring about this model throughout the world?
Well, I think it's fair to say they're not going backwards, at least. There is encouragement in various ways. I have a chapter on imperialism and anti-imperialism. And after all, if the world is now a single world, it is due to Western expansion and now retraction. In principle, retraction while a new political class emerged in the colonial countries. But this varied very much from empire to empire and from country to country. But we still, after all, even in the former colonial countries or the eastern countries, they still talk in Western terms. Even when they're doing the bad stuff, they take Marxism from the West. There is a sort of a level at which the country place is westernized, in not everywhere, but in a very large part of the world. And of course, now English is the international language, and this will be increasingly so with new communications things. There's a book coming out by a guy on English and the Anglo-American approach on this matter of communications and monetary side. And he uses the word, what's he got? Hell, it slipped my mind.
In our present time, The revolution that is taking place in communications through the coming of the internet, I would assume would be a great barrier for totalitarian governments. They have always relied upon the control of communications in order to foster an acceptance of their policies and of their authority. How can they do that in a nation where there are millions of internet users? And it would seem to me that this might be an impossible task for totalitarian governments to achieve, and that the free communication of ideas, which destroys them, will not be possible to hold that back. I hope I'm right. Am I?
Well, I think you're right, up to a point anyway, because this was true even in Russia during the crises of 1991, when the fax machines all over Russia produced posters to go on the lampposts, which would have been impossible. The idea would have been impossible 50 years earlier. But on the other hand, there are regimes which seem to manage Iraq. I don't know how you get your message into Iraq. I mean, it's more difficult for them, but they still have certain powers to resist the outside. It's hard to say. I'll tell you what the word I was thinking about, the Anglosphere, he calls it, the internet, the English-speaking internet and everything else. Let's say there's still a struggle afoot.
In the 18th and 19th centuries, you saw the demise of Christianity, rise of Darwinism and so on, and rise of humanism and relativism. And what are your thoughts on that? Maybe communism's gone, but incipiently, you have multiculturalism and so on in the United States, and you have the rise of egalitarianism and group rights, and if you can't base it on an objective truth, does not that, in a way, threaten freedom? And so do you see, what would you have to say about that?
Well, the assault on objective truth, of course, which is one of the educational errors which we see a lot of now, the Derridaism and so on, is of course a lot of nonsense, and the French historian Alain Besançon, a friend of mine, told me at a conference, they were talking about the effects on European culture of Hollywood films, the French were objecting. And he got up and said, a 100 soft porn Hollywood films do less damage in France than one French philosopher has done in America. But I don't think one can answer all the questions about the nature of religion and science and philosophy and so on. And I haven't really tried to answer those. They raise, faith is one thing and organizations another, and some nations are more religious than others, that being worse than others, and others, you can't tell.
Federal Europe, kind of copycats the United States system of federalism in two major ways. First, the centralization of political power, and second, the redistribution of wealth from more wealthy states to less wealthy states. I remember when I was in the Irish countryside several years back, you would drive along the freeway and see all these signs talking about these structural funds, this highway, brought to you by the EC structural fund for this or that or what have you. And what do you think is the future of the British pound?
Yeah, the Irish are doing fine. They've boomed. It's one of the few countries in Europe that's really boomed, and in part because they quite sensibly took advantage of the European funds. But of course, some of those funds came from countries who don't particularly want to give them. The pound. Well, the betting is that the government and the political class in England are sort of so vague and wimpish about Europe that they will try and drift it in. But there are two very interesting polls. One of them shows that the English are about 60% against the euro. The other one was even more interesting. It was in The Economist about 3 weeks ago. And it said that it asked, in a crisis, what ally would you rely on? It came out 60% America, 17% Europe. And that's when you get down to the real rock bottom, is what the field would be in Britain. I think that the whole European thing, it started off, as you know, the idea was to stop the French fighting the Germans. Well, they should manage that on their own. We don't fight the Scotch. Or the French come to that. But steel community and that sort of thing. Basically, the other thing about Europe economically is that it can't, in fact, stand. They cannot carry out their policies while, not so much England, but Germany and France in particular, they went through the Thatcher Revolution, which did to some extent destroy the total power of the unions and the welfare state. Germany cannot afford its welfare state, and it can't get rid of it because it can't win an election if it does. That at least is gone in England.
Mr. Theroux mentioned at the beginning that the main gist of the talk was going to be what caused the ravages of the century, and it's always been a thought of mine that mere affluence creates these problems and that all the other things can sort of come from the fact that we have come in the last 1,000 years into making a lot of money. Money tends to be concentrated in a specific area, and that people of a certain ilk tend to be drawn to where there are large amounts of money to be controlled. What is your opinion of that particular idea?
Well, looking from the Soviet point of view, they weren't getting any money. They had a country which was very poor, and they made it twice as poor. They probably wanted the money of the West, but they weren't prepared to go through with it, to make any changes which would make them prosperous. They did everything they could to ruin their economy, and which wasn't rich to start with. I think Sakharov said somewhere they wanted a rich state with a poor population. They didn't even have the rich state. It's hard to say. I think to some extent there's a certain sort of money culture which does encourage people to think, oh, what should I do now, and kick and scream. You know that feeling. I get that in academe. Academe, remember, it's not part of capitalism. It lives on capitalism. It's a parasitical on capitalism. They're paid large sums, but they're allowed to denounce capitalism and say, one thing I can't stand is all this capitalist stuff. And we are supporting a huge number of people. I was reading about, I can't remember his name, a professor who is now, him and his wife, and getting between them about 300,000, who writes books not only praising Stalin, but praising Mao and Stalin, and saying they succeeded. And he hates capitalism.
It's pretty much conceded that this last century was a slaughter of innocent men, women, and children, which is just unprecedented. Rommel and Johnson talk about 170 million people. What is, in your opinion, the main reason that took place in this last century?
Well, my theme really is that that all the major slaughters were carried out by people who had accepted certain ideas and were identifying themselves with the totalitarian party and putting these ideas into practice. I mean, Hitler and Stalin, what they did was what they planned to do, what they were happy to do. It was not an accident. There are academics in Germany who try to institutionalize and say, well, it was a matter of institutions. Well, it wasn't a matter of institutions, it was a matter of human motives and actions. Institutions were there, but they used them. I put the major blame on the people who accepted these maniac ideas, and that's been basically what my book's the main context of my book. And I go into that. It's not going to have some detail.
I'm asking for a clarification. My interpretation of the statements you made about the importance of the British and American approach. I'm interpreting that you're meaning the American and British historical experience with classical liberalism, but perhaps you mean more than that, and or perhaps you mean something different. I'm assuming that you don't mean either the experience of George Bernard Shaw or Neville Chamberlain as being part of that tradition. But does the English language itself play a big role in what you're thinking of? And does descendants from either America or Britain, I'm thinking, for example, of the Koreans and the Korean experience, is that part of what you would see as the positive future?
Well, when I say the British and American, I'm not meaning anything racial. I simply mean the tradition. particularly the common law, and not so much democracy as liberty, political liberties, which I found, I mean, there are the countries, first of all, the countries which are like this. We talk about England, Australia, and America and so on, but it also includes the Caribbean countries and the Pacific Island countries. They have the same thing. There was a very good, interesting speech at a recent legal conference here after the Chinese took over Hong Kong by a Hong Kong lawyer who said, a conference in Tucson, I think, he said, We want to keep the common law because we can refer to cases that took place in Wales in 1790. We can talk about New Zealand last year. He wanted the common law as a sort of general unificatory thing. Now, you could also argue, of course, that one of the points that I think we should be arguing, not that I do it very well, is that there is a falling off from the common law culture in both England and America and elsewhere in favor of too much legislation, too much continental style legislation.
So the Marx said, give us power and we'll make everybody equal. And all the intellectuals in the world bought it. And then the fascist said, give us power and we'll make Italy great or Germany great, and some high percent of the intellectuals bought it. And now all the intellectuals have bought another big idea, and that's we're going to save the earth, give us power. And do you want to comment? Is it going to do much damage as fascists?
Well, there's nothing, let us say, ethically wrong in a Marxist who says, I would like a society where everybody is happy. It wasn't the ethical basis of Marxism that was wrong. You could say that even the Nazis, as the great Jewish writer Wesley Grossman says, even the Nazis thought they were acting in the name of good. They thought it was good for the world to have the Germans running it and good for the world to have the Jews killed. So their motives can be called, according to him, good. I don't think motives is quite the point. I think that the thing about it, I have a piece on ism in general, which I call ismology, in the book, and it's two ways, of course, that you can have environmentalism and feminism and various things of that sort, which may contain good points, which are taken to extremes. This raises a question rather similar to the one about corporatism. I was quite astonished at the attempt to feminize the infantry, because then they can't march as far, so that means that you don't have to march as far. It's nice and easy, like the fire brigades. Now, and then when they tried to put women into men's barracks, which is a different point. Cohen, the Secretary of War, opposed it, but his generals accepted it. They'd been so buffaloed and bullied by activists, they didn't know, they were just like these Texaco people. They wanted to give in. They feared they wouldn't get promoted. Even the present government's Secretary for Defense was against it. This is a horrible thought. Sorry, we've gone forever on that one.
Yes. One of the sections in your book deals with education, and I don't know if you spend much time thinking about younger people, but could you, off the top of your head, throw out some books that you would like to see students in Britain and the United States, high school age students, reading? I'm thinking of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, and maybe Kessler's Darkness at Noon, things that you think students in high school should be reading.
I think Darkness at Noon is a very good idea. It doesn't force its point home. You could read it and still be and say good. If you wanted to, that happened. A French student once wrote to Kessler saying, "Your book converted me to communism." I think the first thing is to stop them reading nonsense, and because there's such a lot of nonsense taught. Maybe not from books. I don't know if it's done by sign language or something. If they could just learn a certain amount of tolerable history, even certain types of Marxist history would be better than no history, which is what they get all the time. Mind you, they get also sub and pseudo-Marxist histories, which are worse than Marxism. But I don't know what kids read. We read, I suppose when we were 12, I read the whole of Dickens. I can't say I've read him much since. You know that feeling?
Well, books that would illustrate the theme in your books, the slaughter of the 20th century, how you could interest younger readers, I know that's not your main audience, but people that work in high schools who have read your books want to know how we can interest young people who often are not interested in what they should be.
I think it's a very difficult one in general to interest. When I was young, to get me to look at something I didn't want to, it was really hard going. I had to force it. I remember the worst book I was forced to read when I was doing Greek, when I was about 16, Attic Orators. Four speakers in ancient Greece. The most boring speeches I've ever read in my entire life. they make Laius here look good. Sorry, I shouldn't take up your time.
One more question.
Do you place Fidel Castro in the same class as Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin? And do you have any explanation on why Mr. Castro's been able to survive all these years?
Well, I place him in the same category in a general sense, yes. And he has managed to ruin his country pretty well. Most of the things that they've done, he's managed. I don't know how you account for his survival. It's a strange phenomenon. And what is more, you'd have thought that he would lay off and cool it down. He hasn't really. It's a very extraordinary phenomenon. I knew an Englishman who was ambassador there for a bit, and he thought of Castro as quite a genial rogue. And he thought Guevara was a cold-blooded hypocrite. So it was very much centralized. Well, I think partly because everybody there knows it can't last forever. They think organizing is very difficult. It's very difficult to organize. We were speaking about such things as communications. It's very difficult to organize if the regime isn't on the point of collapse. But for all I know, it'll collapse tomorrow. The Sandinistas, they thought they were in forever, and they made the mistake of having this public election. What a point I mentioned in my book, I'll stand up on this. A friend of mine was in Managua when they had the election in which the Sandinistas lost, and he said in the hotel he was in, several Western European left-wingers burst into tears. So let's hope for something in Havana.
Thank you, Bob. It's a real pleasure to have Bob Conquest speaking here. Those of you who have not read his books, I certainly hope that you will do so. Incidentally, for those of you who were having difficulty getting a copy earlier, we do have some additional copies now, and I know that Bob would be delighted to autograph copies if you would like to get a copy. This is a real treat, I believe. One thing I might add to what has been discussed is that the Independent Institute is an organization that is really not interested in politics. It really is inspired by the kind of scholars like Bob Conquest who spent most of their life dedicated to pursuing truth regardless of left and right or the prejudice of the moment or the biases or even the claims that are made from officialdom. We don't think truth has a political position, but we do think that science and scholarship is an essential way to get to the truth. And the kind of things that we continue to see in the world today, the kind of xenophobia, the kind of nation-statism that you find in too many places is only able to endure when people simply do not have the facts. So I want to thank everyone for joining with us. Again, if you'd like to get a copy of Bob's book, there are copies upstairs, and we hope that you will join us again at our next program. Thank you and good night.